A distinguished scholar speak to us this evening. Before asking Professor Klein to address us, however, it is appropriate to note that this lecture is one of the two Dal Grauer Memorial Lectures given by Professor Klein to UBC audiences. The Dal Grauer Memorial Lectures were set up to honor Dal Grauer, a distinguished British Columbian who made many and impressive contributions to several demanding fields of endeavor: government, research, management, and administration, and universities. In his busy career, Dal Grauer was president of BC Electric and chancellor of UBC, among many other onerous and important tasks he assumed for society. He was trained in economics, so it is fitting that tonight's memorial lecture should be on the subject, Recent Challenges to Keynesian Economic Policies. Professor Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a great honor and privilege to be here, and if so many good citizens are willing to devote a Saturday night to discourses about economics, then it's up to me to try to make it understandable. The subject that I'm going to take up tonight deals with the recent present controversies that are going on all over the world, but particularly in the among the Western industrial democracies, about two things: about the way that we should think about the economy, and that's really for those of us who are professionally involved, those of us in the ivory tower, and what kind of economic theory and what kind of economic system should we be talking about, teaching about in our classes? And secondly, what kind of economic policy should be the dominant policy for the industrial countries of the world? And given the dissatisfaction of the present economic state of the world, the question is, has something gone wrong? Have we been making mistakes? And should we be going back to the drawing boards and recasting economic policy? Such policies are generally guided by an economic theory, and that might mean, should we revise our theories of the economy? It is good, from my point of view, to be in a part of the world that has strong British ties, because at least I would feel here the name Keynesian economics, or the term Keynesian economics, is not a naughty word as it is in many other parts of the world. The Keynesian system of economics became the mainstream model for theorizing about the macroeconomy and for implementing policies based on this system of thought. Mainstream macroeconomics is now under attack both from theoreticians and policymakers, and I propose in this lecture to identify the source of theoretical attack and to comment on the success, failure, or promise of alternative economic policies. Naturally, my frame of reference will be the economy of the United States, but if this analysis is intended to be a contribution to the literature of macroeconomic theory, it should be cast in a framework that refers to the whole world of industrial democracies. It is not going to be an exercise in applied econometrics, which is my daily profession, and although such studies are wanted at this stage, it would be an attempt to be analytical with some reference to quantitative issues. At the present time, there are two major camps with major experiments now going on in the world. In one camp, we would put Mrs. Thatcher and President Reagan. In the other camp, we would certainly put President Mitterrand, possibly the Prime Minister Papandreou of Greece, but that's a rather small country, but newly emerging in the world political scene as adopting the same kinds of policies as Mitterrand. We have in between many combinations, though not departing in any substantive way from one of the two extremes. We have the German policies and the Italian policies and the Benelux policies and the Japanese. By and large, I would say that they are fairly sympathetic to the Reagan-Thatcher policies in the sense that over the last few years, there has been a trend toward conservatism in world politics, and this trend toward conservatism has given the base for the policies of Mrs. Thatcher and President Reagan. Now, they challenge the mainstream model and the mainstream line of policies, and it isn't as though President Mitterrand is adopting what you would call Keynesian policies, but at least his mode of operation would be sympathetic. And I think that what I would call the Mitterrand-Papandreou policies are more attempts to build on to the Keynesian system rather than to attempt to refute it or adopt policies that are 180 degrees different. Now, from the point of view of the debate that is going on in academic circles, I will name three sources of challenge. These are the challenges to Keynesian economics. And one we will call supply-side economics. That has become a popular buzzword in the United States and now picking up some adherence over the rest of the world. A second challenge comes from a rather sophisticated line of reasoning in economics, which is called rational expectations. And the third line of challenge comes from a branch of economics called monetarism. So in the course of this lecture, I want to take up the meaning of supply-side economics, the meaning of rational expectations, the meaning of monetarism, insofar as I can make these terms intelligible to a non-technical audience, and to see to what extent they are serving as a basis for revamping economic policy and our ways of thinking about the economy. Now, before I begin with the actual specific consideration of these three challenges, I want to review with you what I would call a casual empirical look at the world since the end of World War II. On this slide, I have listed the results of three main economic indicators over three decades since the end of World War II, the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s. The three rows are, first, the volume of world trade. Second row is world gross domestic product, or if we just wanted to talk loosely, we would say world production. And the third row is the world inflation rate. The third row refers only to the industrial market economies and the developing economies, and the socialist countries, for which we have very inadequate reports of the correct rates of inflation, are not included, but they are included in world trade and in world production. Now, as I look at these numbers, they tell me the following story, that in the 1950s and in the 1960s, mainstream economics, what we would call the paradigm of economic thinking in that period of time, the Keynesian economic system and the Keynesian medicine, or macro or aggregative demand management of the world economy as we came out of World War II, that system served us very well indeed. Those two decades, the first two post-war decades, 1950s and the 1960s, were decades of unusual material progress throughout the Western world, throughout the world as a whole. World trade grew more than 7% in the 50s, more than 8% in the 60s, and by the end of the 60s, it was growing at 9 or 10%. Those are, in today's world, very heady figures. If you look at last year's figures, there'd be almost a zero in that position. World production grew practically at 5% in the 50s, getting close to 6% in the 60s. That was a very solid performance. And inflation, if you look at it in terms of today's perspective, looks tiny. We would give our right arms to be back to that level of operation. Even though there were many people who complained and worried about the 2 and 3% inflation rates of that period, and worried about the upcreep in inflation in the 1960s. Now, in that period, we have very significant things happening in the world. The 50s had the Korean War, the blocking of the Suez Canal. The 60s had Vietnam. We had, toward the end of the 1960s, the fall of the Bretton Woods system of fixed parities, and these were very big events. There were other major economic events that occurred, but the built-in stabilizers and the system of demand management, both of which were outgrowths of the Keynesian system of thought, which was built in to prevent the return of the world after the war to the conditions of the 1930s, were indeed very successful. Now, it is true, of course, we had the Marshall Plan, we had the devastation of Europe and Japan, the need for rebuilding, we had the Cold War, and they were very significant events in propelling the world economy in that period. But as I study that period in more detail, my conclusion is that the built-in stabilizers, deposit insurance, unemployment compensation, steeply graduated income taxes, various kinds of welfare systems, were indeed very important. And whenever recession struck, they were silently doing their work, and they were very successful. And the world enjoyed an excellent expansion in those two decades. Now, if you look at the third column, you will see that everything suddenly unraveled. The rate of growth of world trade fell. The rate of growth of production fell. And if you look at the very end of the decade, the final years of the decade, it would look even worse if we were make comparable rates of change for that period. And the most distressing number on that chart is the lower right, the 11% inflation rate. So there was a slowing down of growth and a takeoff of inflation. So the whole problem that we have before us tonight to think about is what went wrong in the 1970s, and was the thing or the group of things that went wrong in the 1970s an outgrowth of the application of these Keynesian type policies that served us well in the 50s and 60s, or was it something else? In the sessions that we have been having in quite a different conference at the University of British Columbia in the last few days, we've been looking at, among other problems, problems of energy, and my colleague Professor Halliwell opened his paper by saying it's very important to study the impact of energy on stagflation and performance of economies of the world in recent years. And I would say yes, and the reason that is so important is that we have to sort out an analysis, a retrospective analysis of the 1970s, and say how much was due to the oil embargo, how much was due to what we call the two oil shocks, how much was due to the fall and collapse of the Bretton Woods system of fixed parities, how much was due to the commodity speculation of the early part of the decade, how much was due to the two very major Soviet grain failures that occurred in that period. How much was due to those external shocks? Did we suddenly run into a string of bad luck? And how much was due to the buildup or the carryover of the system of economic management that seemed to work well in the 50s and the 60s. Now, there are many points of view on the interpretation of these events. My own interpretation is that the system that worked well in the 50s and the 60s did not suddenly go wrong, and that system was indeed capable of withstanding the Korean War and the Vietnam War and similar disturbances. It was not capable of coping in full with the so-called oil shocks and the grain failures. But the reason for its inability to cope would not be a reason for throwing out that point of view, or throwing out the theory, or throwing out the policies, but would be, in my interpretation, a reason for building on them and strengthening them. So that really is the problem. And that really is the point of view that divides the two camps in the world today. And we're really in the midst of two very great economic experiments in the world. And neither one has had enough chance to run its course to deliver a definitive opinion, though, of course, Mrs. Thatcher is had almost 3 years now, and we can see some of the results. My own interpretation would be that the Reagan-Thatcher approach has not proved to be successful and will not prove to be successful, but still it is an experiment. And the other kind of approach to build on and strengthen the system of aggregate demand management is an approach that I would prefer, but still it is one that needs to be proven. If we look upon this from the point of view of academic economics, we would say that the failure of the international currency system, the failure and breakdown of the Bretton Woods system of fixed parities is an important aspect of Keynesian economics, because Keynes was one of the architects of Bretton Woods. And indeed, he did concern himself toward the very end of his life with the problem of world order. And that system was devised in order to allow individual countries to pursue independent and autonomous economic policies for managing their domestic economies while not being terribly concerned one country at a time with the overall management of the world economy, because that was in the hands of the Bretton Woods system or the International Monetary Fund. So the analysis of the problems of the world that arise from the present operation of the floating rate system and the international problems that we're seeing these very days, when we see the conflict between exchange rate policy and U.S. interest rate policy, we see that we're thrown right back into the kind of dilemma that countries were in when Keynes devised the Bretton Woods system. Also, I want to remind you that in World War II, Keynes wrote a book at the very beginning called How to Pay for the War, and it was a book that was very seriously concerned with the inflation problem. So in this system of thought, there is no attempt to skirt the problems of international economic affairs. There is no intent to skirt the problem of dealing with inflation, although one may very well question whether the way of thinking about these two issues was an adequate way. Now, having identified the problem and the situation of the world, let me take up now some of the main issues dealing with the questions of the challenge. The question of the challenge is how to interpret the concept of supply-side economics, how to interpret rational expectations, and how to interpret monetarism. Now let me come first to the concept of supply-side economics. The students of economics know as well as anyone else, going back to the great English master Alfred Marshall, that the trite expression is quite correct: both blades of the scissors do the cutting. And it is neither a question of all supply nor a question of all demand, but it is, of course, a question of the mixture of the two. Now, in the United States, the present political debate, particularly stemming from the advice that has been given to President Reagan, supply-side economics has taken on a very particular meaning, a meaning that I would call a populist meaning. And supply-side economics in the United States today means large-scale, across-the-board tax cutting. Some people have said that perhaps it would be better called incentive economics, because the intent is to cut marginal tax rates by such large amounts and repeated amounts, in 3 years in succession, in fact, that people will work harder because they will keep a larger fraction of each dollar earned after tax, and that will raise productivity, an essential ingredient in turning around the present economic situation, and also that people will save more. And by saving more, They will then relieve pressure on capital markets and indeed a pressure upward on interest rates such as we are seeing at the present time, and that will make the revival of the economy easier to implement. Now, I believe that there is a grain of truth to this version of supply-side economics, but the catch is, and this is a technical issue, that the effects are too small and the effects are too slow. And the people who advised the president made wild judgments, were not professional judgments. They were political judgments that there would be an immediate effect and it would be very big and the country would be turned around, even within the first year, within the year 1981. The result was, instead of being turned around, we generated a recession, and I believe those were very ill-advised tax cuts to be formed as they were, particularly 3 years running. The third year is giving such a fright to the investment community that there is depression in the bond markets and high interest rates when these issues are confronted with simultaneous tight money policy on the part of the central banking authorities. And when we come later in this discussion to consider the issue of monetarism, we will see that the tight money policy is also part of the system of thought that is presently challenging Keynesian economics. So I would argue in the first place that supply-side economics is misconceived as it is put forward. There is, in my opinion, a very respectable supply-side economics. The economics of natural resources, such as we've been studying for the last few days in a conference here. The economics of the supply of energy, the economics of the demographic structure of the labor force, the economics of the supply of other natural resources or materials besides energy, as well as the economics of incentives. And if all of this is put together, there is a system of thought that can incorporate very useful and respectable ideas from the supply side. If I were to give this a very technical name, I would call this the marriage of the Keynesian system of thought and the Leontief system of thought. The Leontief system of thought means the inter-industry flow and structure of production or input-output analysis. And I do believe that these two can be successfully put together within your own country. That is, in fact, my interpretation of the work of the Economic Council of Canada in what is called the Candide Project. Similar studies are carried on in my country, in Norway, in other parts of the world, and that, I believe, is an extension of the Keynesian system of thought and not a challenge to it. I think what it means is that economic policy needs to be more than macro policy. It is not a question particularly of whether it is demand management or supply analysis. Supply management is too strong a term because that means socialism. So I will say supply analysis, euphemistically. And it's not a question of that. It is a question of macro policy alone. And my view is that macro policy alone can do only so much. And the present problems of the world, the present problems of the typical industrial economy of the West is not not purely in the macro sphere. The present problems are environmental problems, productivity problems, problems that require very specific policies that we might call structural policies. And we must combine structural policies with macro policies, just as we must combine a structural theory, like the Leontief theory, together with the macro theory of the Keynesian system. And this I call a constructive challenge from the point of view of supply-side economics, and not a revolutionary challenge as it is viewed in Washington today. I think the events of the past year have probably turned off a lot of the policymakers in Washington at the present stage, or are about to turn them off from the concepts of supply-side economics. Nevertheless, it is still a live issue. Now, let me go on to the concept of rational expectations. That's more difficult for me to explain. But let me first say, what is the role of expectations in economic analysis, and how is it implemented at the present time? The role of expectations is straightforward and simple. It merely asserts that people make decisions and people act on the basis of expected incomes, expected prices, expected interest rates. No one can very well quarrel with that point of view. It is a point of view of individual behavior that appears to be very sensible and sound. Now, traditionally in interpreting economic policy and economic theory in this period of time in the 50s and the 60s when things were going well, as revealing expectations through the past history of economic variables. Expected price was a weighted combination of historical prices. Expected interest rate, a weighted combination of historical interest rates, on the assumption that the average intelligent citizen would say, if I'm to make a judgment about future prices on which to act, I will look at the present level of prices, the rate at which they are increasing, the rate at which they're accelerating, and so on. It is not all-encompassing, but it is a fairly simple and straightforward way of thinking. Now, that may have been inadequate, but as statistical model builders, I think we have gone one step further. At least I and my colleagues, several of my colleagues, have used the techniques of sample surveys and gone into the field and asked people, what do you expect for prices? What do you expect for incomes? What do you expect for the economy as a whole? And we have taken the statistical results of sampling investigations and put them in as direct magnitudes in our statistical models of the economy. That is indeed the way the Wharton model of the United States economy functions in certain areas at this present time in terms of expected investment outlays by business, in terms of orders for goods and expected housing outlays on the basis of starts or holes in the ground. And to some extent, where possible, expected prices and expected household purchases. I think it is better to go to the people and find out what expectations are, and also to make a statistical modeling of the way those personal expectations are formed, rather than to hypothesize on the basis of purely speculative economic thinking as to how expectations are formed. Now, the theory of rational expectations says that the typical citizen has the same range of information as the economic bureaucrat or the main economic decision maker who is making either a big scale corporate decisions or making decisions in public offices. I doubt that the average citizen has the same range of information. The average citizen is surely not updated as quickly as either the expert or the official. And I don't think that the average citizen has a frame of reference for analyzing the economy and thinking about the economy, which is like that of the professional analyst. And I think that the idea of rational expectations is somewhat contrived to come out with a certain result. And the proponents of this theory argue that since the average citizen has the same information base as the policymaker, as soon as the policymaker makes a decision to change the economy, the average citizen will use the same mode of reasoning and the same basis of information and outguess the policymaker and take an action which anticipates the policymaker's move and thereby negates it. And the one common thread that we find through these three challenges to the present system of economic management and analysis is that it is a prescription for non-intervention. It is a prescription for passive adaptation in the economy, and it is a prescription for minimal policy action. So if the principle of rational expectations as a challenge to modern economics says that it is futile to make economic policy because people will outfox the policymaker, then the policymaker should do nothing. And the supply-side economics argument is, as it has been interpreted, only as it has been interpreted in this populist version, is if we cut taxes drastically and thereby force governments to cut budgets, we will reduce government activity as much as possible, return as much as possible the economy to the private sector, and then minimize public action. So it is a once and for all action to cut taxes vigorously and then have a minimum of public intervention. Now, I think it is quite correct to say that people may make expectation judgments on the basis of a wide range of indicators. And one could go beyond this simplified idea that one looks only at the history of the thing that is being expected. I think that is sound, but I think it is unsound to say that there is any confluence or convergence of the way people interpret this span of information and this span of indicators. I think there is great diversity and great heterogeneity in the forming of expectations, and a great difference between the way the average citizen forms it and the way the policymaker forms it. Therefore, I would argue that the challenge of rational expectations has yet to be proven. The burden of the proof is on the proponents of this theory, and personally, I don't see anything in this theory to overturn the way economic policy is presently conducted. Now let me take up the third challenge, monetarism. Monetarism says that not only is the monetary sector of the economy important, not only do things like money supply and credit market conditions matter a great deal, but that money is the central feature for economic control, and that a very fixed and stable rule for control of money supply growth should be the main policy intervention for the economy, and indeed the most vigorous proponent of this point of view, Milton Friedman, would argue that he would hope that the central bank would simply control some monetary aggregate and then let the market do the rest, or to use the language of the President of the United States, to rely on the magic of the market. So the magic of the market, with a fixed rule on money supply, becomes the main policy prescription. And I think you will see that that policy prescription dovetails very nicely with the policy prescriptions of either rational expectations or supply-side economics. It means very little activist economic policy. It means only the economic policy to put the money supply on a steady, sound growth path. There are many occasions in which these three factions, the proponents of these three factions, have been rumored in the press to be bickering and arguing in Washington. That may be true to some extent, but nevertheless, there is one thing that binds them all together, and then that is this policy of hardly any government active economic decision making and almost entire reliance on what is called the magic of the market. Now, in order to justify the view of monetarism, there are two ways of looking at a basic relationship of the economic system that are essential to this way of thinking. One view is that in our society, there should be near proportionality between the money supply and the value of economic activity, the total value of production. Indeed, the concept called GDP, when measured for a particular country and not for the world as a whole, would be one method of measuring the total value of production, but in current prices. And money supply should be proportional to that. The factor of proportionality would be the reciprocal of the velocity of circulation or the turnover of money supply. I claim that the success of the implementation of monetarism depends on the stability, or a fancier term would be the parametric nature of the velocity of circulation. Now, statistical studies in the United States indicate that the more narrowly we define money supply, the more unstable is the concept of velocity that would be associated with it. The more broadly we define money supply, until we are so broad as to encompass total credit, the more stable is the concept of velocity, and indeed it is quite stable. But the monetary authorities have very little direct control over total credit, and they have great control over the monetary base. So if we pit controllability against stability of the velocity of circulation, you can see that we have a confrontation. To give a meaningful basis for velocity in terms of the quantity theory of money, we have to go to something like total credit. But to get something the authorities can control, we have to go back to something like the monetary base. In the United States, in October of 1979, what is called the Saturday Night Massacre, was, I forget exactly which Saturday, but I think it was the first Saturday in October, new operating rules were instituted by the Federal Reserve Board in the United States. Now you can see that up to the latter months of 1969, this particular money supply magnitude, M1, was fluctuating in a very narrow range. Things were very nice. And suddenly, as soon as the authorities adopted monetarist operating rules and chose as a new target the growth of money supply, they messed up the whole situation. And the fluctuations became wider. And that has been one of the criticisms. We have very wide fluctuations now that the authorities are trying to be monetarist. The vertical line is a line that separates prediction from history, and the vertical line is on this chart for quite another purpose. So that looks very stable, but that's just a smooth projection. The important part to look at is the part between October 1979 and that vertical line where we get the great instability. I think there are fundamental reasons why it is very difficult for the monetary authorities in the United States, and I think elsewhere too, to hit their targets on monetary control. The banking system, the financial system, is now undergoing very great change, revolutionary change, electronic change. And if you think of such things as checking accounts that bear interest, or the NOW accounts, or money market funds, which are now neighboring $200 billion in outstandings in the United States, and paying the ordinary citizen the kind of interest rate that only big investors used to get. Or if you think of electronic funds transfer, or if you think of the widespread use of automatic tellers, credit cards, euro currency balances, and so on, you will see that the monetary system has been extremely inventive. It is under extreme change. The authorities don't even know the correct seasonal adjustments for the concepts now because they are so new. And on this graph, you'll see I have M1B. The B has just been erased from January, and that is another indicator of the uncertainty on the part of the authorities what to call the different magnitudes, because they're changing, not every day, but they're changing every few months. And when the authorities bring money market funds under control by requiring reserves against them, then the banking system will think up a new instrument. And that has been the way things have gone. And very responsible members of the Federal Reserve System, namely the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Mr. Tony Solomon, believe that the banking system is undergoing such great change that it is indeed very difficult, or maybe not possible, for the monetary authorities to carry out effectively a monetarist economic policy. Now, I said the first thing that was necessary was stability of velocity. And there is instability of velocity, and that instability of velocity is associated with the concept of controllability. A second thing is the relationship between money supply and inflation. And in order that control of the money supply be translated into control of inflation, which is the central point of present policy of Mrs. Thatcher and Mr. Reagan, you have to adopt the following point of view. That basically, real production is in the neighborhood of full employment output and temporarily fluctuates around it, and in the medium to long term settles down at full employment. And if that term in the relationship is fixed, then the proportionality exists between money supply and price level. And so the authorities are pushing on money supply, are pushing it down in order to hold down the rate of inflation. Now that is the point at which it is very important to disentangle what happened in the 1970s. That is the point to say, is it money supply? Was it mismanagement? And was the Shah of Iran correct when he criticized the Western nations for not keeping their economic house in order and saying the blame is not with OPEC? Was he correct? Or was it a question of the kinds of disturbances that existed during the 1970s? Let's take a look at the chart of inflation during that period. This is a chart of the rate of change of the consumer price during the 1970s. The chart begins in 1970, and it is also a projection, so I'm not particularly recommending that we pay special attention this time to the years from 1983 to 1986, but look at the years in between. There was a run-up. First, the decade started out at 5% inflation. This is a run-up of prices following the oil embargo. The oil embargo occurred in November 73. This is 74, 75. And then you can see that inflation gradually worked its way out of the system. This is the period of the Iranian Revolution, the fall of the Shah, the second oil shock, and now we're gradually in this process. Here's where we are right now in trying to work inflation out of the system. Now, I would not be one to argue very simple relationships. You can see OPEC pricing, world inflation, a relaxation, and then a relaxation of inflation, and then a run-up of OPEC pricing again, inflation again. That doesn't really prove the point, but the idea of gross association, when it is as strong as that, must be very compelling in our thinking about the causes of inflation during the 1970s. Well, I would say that in the long run, in the medium term to long run, there may be some evidence in favor of the quantity theory of money or the relationship that is crucial to monetarism. Though I don't think that proportionality between money supply and the value of economic production necessarily implies a causal relation that is a basis for policy, Nevertheless, there is some medium-term association. But in the short run, in forming economic policy this year and next year and the year after, there is very little stability to that relationship. And when monetarism became very fashionable in the United States, it was some time ago, it was in the beginning of Richard Nixon's administration, the monetarists were very confident that they had found the right relationship and built statistical systems based on it. As soon as those statistical systems came up against commodity speculation, the oil embargo, the Soviet grain failures, those statistical systems performed very badly. So badly that the proprietors, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, declared in print that their system was never meant for short-term analysis of the economy, that it holds only in the long run. And I think it does have some medium to long-term validity, but certainly not an adequate basis for immediate short-term policy analysis of the economy. A final aspect about monetarism is that it is very one-sided. It says that not only that money matters, but only money matters, or money alone matters, or money is everything. That is one way of looking at it. Now that is, in my opinion, too doctrinaire to form a basis for economic policy making. And in economic thinking, we usually generalize, and when we go to such a concept which is familiar in science and engineering as the theory of control, or control theory methods, we usually say that the authorities can adopt multiple targets, not just one target. There's no reason whatsoever why there cannot be simultaneously target for the exchange rate, target for interest rate, target for M1, target for M2, meaning different concepts of the money supply, and optimize some weighted combination of those multiple targets. That would make some kind of trade-off between interest rate fluctuations, for example, and money supply fluctuations. But when we have the doctrinaire position that we have today, so that focus is entirely on money supply, then the doctrine says, let interest rates go where they will. And it is wrong for the authorities to pay attention. And that is indeed what is happening. Interest rates are going where they will, and they're going sky high, or they have been. And that has been the hang-up for the recovery in Western Europe, as well as the recession that began in the United States and now shows every indication of spreading to this country as well. So a dropping of the doctrinaire point of view and a spreading out to be at least as reasonable and general as the multiple target approach of exchange rate policy would, as I see it, be preferable. Now, as I look over these three challenges, supply side economics, rational expectations, monetarism, I say from either from a theoretical point of view, they are not satisfactory, or from the point of view of running the world as things are working out today, it isn't very satisfactory. We have today the United States going into a recession, maybe pulling this country into recession, and we have a nipping of the recovery movement that had been expected to get underway in Western Europe. So we've come to, not to a crisis, but to a very precarious state within the world economy. And I ask this question, is there another way? Not necessarily saying, on the one hand, we have the Mitterrand policy, and the other hand, we have the Reagan-Thatcher policy. Somewhere in between, is there a way? Or is the Mitterrand way the alternative, but is there a third way? And I say, yes, there is a third way. There is a way that has not been tried. The third way consists, in my opinion, of what we call industrial policy. It means industrial policy, or sometimes called the reindustrialization of the United States, and it could be the reindustrialization of many of the Western countries, where that policy, together with the macro policy of the Keynesian system, that is to say, if the necessary parts of economic policy are put into place with macro demand management, then the structural parts could come from a careful and judicious application of industrial policy. The objectives of industrial policy are to raise productivity growth and to move the competitive position of each country using such policy toward more efficiency. In looking at past performance, I would say the Japanese industrial policy of the 1960s was eminently successful. And it appears that the disruptive effects of the 1970s have been absorbed for the Japanese economy, preparing the economy for a new round of industrial policy in the 1980s. Similarly, I believe that French indicative planning was also successful as an industrial policy in the 1960s. It remains to be seen whether the new directions for French industrial policy are going to be as successful as the previous ones. But I think we can cite the French and the Japanese cases as successful examples. There are, of course, failures, and this route for economic policy is chancy. I think the stakes are high, and it is a situation in which some chances should be taken. And I believe the United States are very well situated for developing and implementing a successful industrial policy at the present time. Our present administration in the United States came to power on the basis of promises that we would not have to go through a painful process of recessionary adjustment with rising unemployment in order to bring down the rate of inflation. This is plainly false, as we have the recession unfolding before our very eyes, and unemployment is very high. A careful and well-considered industrial policy, together with other structural policies dealing with the environmental issues, the demographic issues, and similar sectoral or micro problems, offers an alternative. These fundamental policy changes are medium term, require 2 to 3 years before their beneficial effects should begin to show through. But the short-run transitional problems for dealing with the immediate recession can be addressed through complementary demand management policies. Thus, the analysis that I'm trying to give to you, that they will prove not to be successful if they are implemented with the same degree of doctrinaire rigor that they've been implemented for the last 2 or 3 years. Thank you.
Professor Klein. Klein has agreed to answer questions. There is a minor technical problem which concerns me. We'd like to take our speaker to the overflow room, but I'm not sure whether anybody is in the overflow room. Did you check that? So while the honorary secretary of the Institute is checking that, perhaps we could have a question or two to Professor Klein, and then if there are people there, we will take him down. Mrs. Nemetz?
Professor Klein, I know you didn't have time to address yourself to every issue, but I'm just wondering, when you're talking about the magic of the marketplace, you didn't mention that so much of the resources of the United States are going into munitions, and therefore the marketplace really isn't so free.
You want to comment on that?
Oh, really? Yes.
Yeah, let me state that point. When I mentioned the concept of the magic of the market, I did not take up the issue that a great deal of activity in the United States presently is going into military and defense spending, and that does not operate on purely a market basis, or perhaps even stronger, on a market basis at all. Yeah.
The other part of the question is wondering about the industrialization of the United States. How important is the transfer of ownership to the OPEC powers today? Is this going to affect the way Britain was affected after the First World War?
On the issue of industrialization or industrial policy, how will that be affected by the fact that a great deal of ownership of the industrial establishment has been transferred to the OPEC powers? How will that be affected by that transfer? Let me take up the first issue. The question of military spending in the United States is really a question of magnitude. Rather than principle. I think there is a basic point of view in the United States now that we under-supported the military in the past few years, that some redressing of the balance is necessary, so there must essentially be a very major expenditure on military facilities. One might very well question whether the present administration is trying to do too much and indeed pushing parts of the economy toward what really amounts to guns better, a kind of trade-off, even though there are many unemployed resources in other parts of the economy. I also believe that many aspects of this are not free market aspects. That was not meant to be the magic of the market, other than the fact that the main suppliers are private sector suppliers, but the demand is public demand. It's not marketplace demand. It is simply a decision of authorities about how much they want. And where the present government of the United States would like to return as much activity as possible to the private sector by building up a strong military, it is in fact negating some of that movement toward the private sector, because these are public decisions. The military thing is a hard thing to deal with. Let me put it in the following perspective. President Carter essentially kept to a military expenditure that kept pace with inflation. So we would say for a number of years there was zero real growth in the military establishment. Some people might even say negative. When he tried to get SALT II approved by Congress, he had to make a political deal and accept, in order to get SALT II approved, he had to accept 3% real as a political bargain. Then in the event, the whole debate veered away from SALT II, never got implemented, and the Soviets marched into Afghanistan. And then President Carter shifted to a harder line and moved the military establishment to 6% real, went beyond the 3%. And at the time he left office, military expenditures were growing at about 6% a year. They're growing at about that rate now. They could be pushed up to as much as 10%, but not immediately. There are many people who feel that it is simply overdone, and that may cause undue burden on the civilian part of the U.S. economy. So that would be my response to the first question. As to the second comment, it is true that there is a great deal of OPEC investment in the United States. A great deal of it is in treasury bills, other bank accounts. A great deal of it is in real estate, in metropolitan area office buildings and apartments, and a great deal of it is in farmland. Some of it is in the industrial sector as well. And then also some of it is in the financial sector. I don't think at the present time it is anywhere near being a danger, and doesn't really stand in the way of blocking industrial expansion. Now, at the present time, the standard projection for the next few years is that the OPEC surplus is going to dwindle fast, and the deficit of the industrial countries, including the United States, against the OPEC countries will improve, not necessarily be turned into surplus, but improve, partly because of falling or weakening oil prices, at least for the present, partly because of a high tendency or propensity of the OPEC nations to import, and partly because of a world inflation and the growth projects of the OPEC countries. So that in the end, the rate of buildup of the OPEC balances vis-a-vis the industrial countries will be weakened a lot. It will be much slower, and so I don't say it's a piddling thing or trivial, but I don't see it as the danger that could prevent policies of industrialization from taking place.
You mentioned on several occasions the Russian grain failure as having an impact, in some sense, similar to the oil embargo. Would you mind enlarging on that?
Question is, how did the Soviet grain failures of the 1970s impact on the economic development of that period? If you recall, there were two sides to the issue in 1972, which was not the first grain failure, but the first of the 70s and the first massive one. There were some in the 60s as well. That grain failure first caught the United States by surprise because of the way the Soviets made the purchases, little bits, piece by piece, without letting the authorities know. They, in a sense, outfoxed the American authorities because they bought subsidized grain, subsidized by the American government, by doing it that way. But that was more a matter of their being good market men. The more serious aspect was that it practically depleted our stocks. And it took us more than a year to rebuild them. I think we did an excellent job of rebuilding them very fast. But during 1973 and 1974, we had a massive force all at once. We had commodity price speculation in non-ferrous and other industrial materials in the summer of 73. We had very low grain stocks because of the Soviet purchases and their failure. And so the price of food was very high, and the price of industrial materials was very high. And then we had the first oil shock, and the price of oil went very high. And all of that happened at once. Now, the reason that's important, and the reason it was important to look at it that way, is that we must go back and reassess and say how much of the inflation that occurred was due to this unique event, and how much was due to the fact that we didn't really have Soviet purchases under control. Under control by meaning they weren't being monitored. I think now we're very well aware of that issue, and we don't necessarily prevent them or implement them, but at least we monitor them and know what is happening. And the second very large grain failure occurred in 1975, and that had an impact on world prices. And I think it is a question of saying how much of the unfortunate experience of the 1970s was temporary and problematic and due to the structural impulses that occurred, the disturbances that occurred, and how much was due to monetary mismanagement. And also, since we have found that we can recoup our stocks within a couple of years by simply calling idle acreage back into production, that a food shock like that is not enduring, though it is bad when it occurs. So it was a question of understanding it, knowing how to deal with it, and it is not an issue of telling the Federal Reserve to tighten up, but it is an issue of getting the acres back into operation, getting the supply of grain back. So the guidelines for economic policy are not monetarist guidelines. For that, they're agricultural guidelines. And that does not negate the kind of policies that we were following. This is the inherent importance of those events. Yes?
Sorry, Professor Klein, you seem skeptical that supply-side economics will turn around what seems to be a $100 billion deficit. In your opinion, what will be required to turn it around, number one? Number two, under Keynesian approach, does this cumulative deficit ever have to become zero again sometime in the future?
The question is, if supply-side economics did not turn around the very large United States deficits, what will? And secondly, does Keynesian economics worry about that deficit or have anything to say about it, or can it do away with it? Will it ever come back to zero? There are many options that are open. I mean, these options that are open are all contradictions to stated policy lines of the present government, but I personally believe that some contradictory step will have to be taken because they're, in a sense, painted into a corner. The president can raise some taxes. The president can rescind, have a tax rescission, or rescind some taxes. Would mean rescind some tax cuts, which would bring up revenues. Or the president can cut expenditures, or the monetary authorities can change their policy and be easier. Many combinations of these could occur. I will just give you some rough guidelines. The biggest single thing that could be done is to rescind the July 1983 tax cut. The July 1982 tax cut, I think, is wanted. And that is an ironic view, because the people who proposed it on the grounds that taxation and deficits should not be used as an implement of economic stabilization, but only taxation should only be used as a means of paying for necessary government activities. And now they're saying, isn't it nice that we have a cushion of a tax cut when we're in recession? So we have contradictory viewpoints, but it is nice, and we need it, and it will be very important in the usual Keynesian way of turning around the economy during this year, 1982. As the economy picks up, I believe it will, we should not go on to the third installment of the tax cut. So that doesn't do much for the present year's deficit, but it does a lot for the next year's deficit. It does more than any other single thing that people have been able to think of. I mean, it's worth probably $30 or $40 billion of deficit remission. Another possible thing, it's only a possible thing, would be doing away with controls on prices of natural gas, and then having a windfall profits tax on some of the gains. That would be worth about half to two-thirds as much. Both of them are very big revenue items. Now, those are only examples, but they are examples that are along this line of rescinding some tax measures or putting on other tax measures. And also, going back to the first question of the evening, there could be some cuts in the military budget, and that would also do something along these lines. So there are many possibilities. And I think the cuts in the military budget would not exacerbate the recessionary situation, since there is a lot of reason to believe that the military budget is too much for the capacity of that sector to deliver at the present time in the short run. Now, does Keynesian economics take us toward zero, or intend to? Not necessarily, but the best way to get toward zero is to run a strong economy for quite a few years. So any policy, whether it's a Keynesian type policy or not, any policy that gets the economy moving again so that we generate a good tax base, and that we generate a low transfer payments base, any policy that does that will move us in that direction. And I would say 4 years of good solid recovery, and we could get toward zero. And I think that Keynesian policies plus an industrial policy could do that.
Professor Klein has had a long evening. I think I'll allow one more question, and the gentleman sitting on the floor who has had a long evening sitting on the floor will have the last chance.
Okay.
Thanks. I had a question about your table, the one that you put up at the beginning.
Yes.
Concerning the inflation rates in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, I guess these are for many, many countries combined. And I was wondering how money supplies of the countries that would have been involved in that calculation would have related to those inflation rates. Would they have been similar growth in money supplies, or would it be impossible to measure?
The question is concerning the bottom row, and you want to know how, first, what those numbers mean and how they are related to the money supplies of the countries that are involved. That's an interesting issue. And I will say this is a sort of a crude statistical approximation. These are global numbers. And the way they're constructed is that we find the inflation rate in France and the inflation rate in Germany and the inflation rate in the United States and Canada and country after country on a nearly exhaustive basis for everything except the socialist countries. And we form a weighted average. And the numbers and the weighted average are the relative importance of those countries in world production. And that is the number that you see here. And those are consumer prices in those countries. It's a weighted average of those countries' consumer prices in their own currency units, domestic currency units. Now, if we go through a similar global calculation and look at world money supply, world production, world price, over the long period, over this 30-year, three-decade period, you'll find approximately a satisfaction of the quantity theory of money, that is, the rate of growth of money supply will approximate, for all of these countries together, will approximately equal the rate of growth of prices plus the rate of growth of output. And that's an interesting statistical issue. But it does appear on a global world basis that the quantity relationship over a long period of time holds.
Would there be a causal relationship?
I don't think that it's causal. Now, my reason for saying that, I have to put in somewhat sophisticated terms, something like this. Money supply and the value of output or the inflation rate and real production are all dependent variables, or in technical terms we say endogenous variables. They're all generated out of the economic process together. And we find that the ratio of those two dependent variables does happen to be fairly proportional, fairly close to a proportional relationship. Now, that doesn't imply causality. That just says that two dependent magnitudes happen to have the same path. That would be my interpretation.
Professor John Hallowell will thank our speaker on behalf of the Institute.
It's always dangerous to give me this amplification equipment. Lawrence Klein, among economists of Nobel caliber, is not alone in his deep concern for the big issues of the day. Where he is unique among such economists is the way in which he tests his ideas and the ideas of others daily and yearly against the real numbers that the world turns up. Indeed, he hasn't just done this for the past, but he continues to do it for the future. If there were a World Cup of economic forecasters, Lawrence Klein would have led those standings every year for the last three decades. Indeed, you'd find that all of those in the top 10 would have had Wharton models stenciled on their skis. Or if not, or in addition, they would have been coached by Professor Klein. This is true not just for the United States, where his model building started, but right around the world. If you'd asked almost anyone 15 years ago whether it would have been possible to set up a United Nations of model builders that would bring in the best of models from around the world and construct them into a regularly operating system for analyzing the world economy and forecasting world trade, most of us in the trade would have said that was fancy. And yet, he has done it. And it's a great credit to not only his analytical skills and his great prestige, but also his diplomacy that whole project has succeeded and the world as a whole is much better for it. What he's shown us tonight is that he's not only the World Cup leader in economic forecasting, but he's a very strong World Cup level expositor. Indeed, I might suggest to Alan Cairns that if he's going to carry on with the very noble but risky procedure of running a voluntary tax system in order to keep the Vancouver Institute going for the next 50 years, what he really needs as a drawing card is somebody like Lawrence Klein on a regular basis. I'd like to suggest... Can't get rid of me that easily. I'd like to suggest on behalf of the Grauer Committee and the Vancouver Institute and the whole university and urban community of Vancouver that I hope the rest of you share with me the wish that Alan Cairns and his successors will do everything they can to implement that policy and bring Lawrence Klein back to us again.